4. Lvov, the husband of Natalie, Kitty's sister, had spent all his life in the capitals and abroad, where he had been educated and had been in the diplomatic service. During the previous year, he had left the diplomatic service, not owing to any unpleasantness. He never had any unpleasantness with anyone, and was transferred to the palace department in Moscow in order to give his two boys the best education possible. In spite of the striking contrast in their habits and views, and the fact that Lvov was older than Levin, they had seen a great deal of one another that winter and had taken a great liking to each other. Lvov was at home, and Levin went in to him unannounced. Lvov, in a housecoat with a belt and in chamois leather shoes, was sitting in an armchair, and with a pince-nez with blue lenses, he was reading a book that stood on a reading desk, while in his beautiful hand he held a half-burned cigar carefully away from him. His handsome, delicate, and still youthful-looking face, to which his curly, glistening silver hair gave a still more aristocratic air, lighted up with a smile when he saw Levin. "Capital! I intended to send for you. How's Kitty? Sit here, it's more comfortable." He got up and pushed up a rocking chair. "Have you read the last circular in the Journal de St. Petersburg? I think it's excellent," he said with a slight French accent. Levin told him what he had heard from Katavasov was being said in Petersburg, and after talking a little about politics, he told him of his interview with Metrov and the Learned Society's meeting. To Lvov, it was very interesting. "That's what I envy you, that you are able to mix in these interesting scientific circles," he said. And as he talked, he passed as usual into French, which was easier for him. "It's true I haven't the time for it. My official work and the children leave me no time. And then I'm not ashamed to own that my education has been too defective." "That I don't believe," said Levin with a smile, feeling, as he always did, touched at Lvov's low opinion of himself, which was not in the least put on from a desire to seem or to be modest, but was absolutely sincere. "Oh, yes, indeed. I feel now how badly educated I am. To educate my children, I positively have to look up a great deal, and in fact, actually to study myself. For it's not enough to have teachers. There must be someone to look after them. Just as on your land you want laborers and an overseer. See what I'm reading?" He pointed to Buslov's Grammar on the desk. "It's expected of Misha, and it's so difficult. Come, explain to me." "Here," he says. Levin tried to explain to him that it couldn't be understood, but that it had to be taught. But Lvov would not agree with him. "Oh, you're laughing at it. On the contrary, you can't imagine how, when I look at you, I'm always learning the task that lies before me. That is, the education of one's children." "Well, there's nothing for you to learn," said Lvov. "All I know," said Levin, "is that I have never seen better brought up children than yours, and I wouldn't wish for children better than yours." Lvov visibly tried to restrain the expression of his delight, but he was positively radiant with smiles. "If only they're better than I, that's all I desire. You don't know yet all the work," he said, "with boys who've been left like mine to run wild abroad. You'll catch up with all that. They're such clever children. The great thing is the education of character. That's what I learn when I look at your children." "You talk of the education of character. You can't imagine how difficult that is. You have hardly succeeded in combating one tendency when others crop up, and the struggle begins again. If one had not a support in religion, you remember we talked about that, no father could bring children up relying on his own strength alone without that help." This subject, which always interested Levin, was cut short by the entrance of the beauty, Natalia Alexandrovna, dressed to go out. "I didn't know you were here," she said, unmistakably feeling no regret, but a positive pleasure in interrupting this conversation on a topic she had heard so much of that she was by now weary of it. "Well, how is Kitty? I'm dining with you today. I tell you what, Arseny," she turned to her husband, "you take the carriage." And the husband and wife began to discuss their arrangements for the day. As the husband had to drive to meet someone on official business, while the wife had to go to the concert and some public meeting of a committee on the Southeastern question, There was a great deal to consider and settle. Levin had to take part in their plans as one of themselves. It was settled that Levin should go with Natalie to the concert and the meeting, and that from there they should send the carriage to the office for Arseny, and he should call for her and take her to Kitty's, or that, if he had not finished his work, he should send the carriage back and Levin would go with her. "He's spoiling me," Lvov said to his wife. "He assures me that our children are splendid, when I know how much bad there is in them." "Arseny goes to extremes, I always say," said his wife. "If you look for perfection, you will never be satisfied." And it's true, as Papa says, that when we were brought up, there was one extreme. We were kept in the attic, while our parents lived in the best rooms. Now it's just the other way. The parents are in the washhouse, while the children are in the best rooms. Parents now are not expected to live at all, but to exist altogether for their children. "Well, what if they like it better?" Lvov said with his beautiful smile touching her hand. "Anyone who didn't know you would think you were a stepmother, not a true mother." "No, extremes are not good in anything," Natalie said serenely, putting her paper knife straight in its proper place on the table. "Well, come here, you perfect children," Lvov said to the two handsome boys who came in, and after bowing to Levin, went up to their father, obviously wishing to ask him about something. Levin would have liked to talk to them, to hear what they would say to their father, but Natalie began talking to him, and then Lvov's colleague in the service, Makotin, walked in, wearing his court dress, to go with him to meet someone, and a conversation was kept up without a break upon Herzegovina, Princess Korzenskaya, the town council, and the sudden death of Madame Apraxina. Levin even forgot the commission entrusted to him. He recollected it as he was going into the hall. "Oh, Kitty told me to talk to you about Oblonsky," he said as Lvov was standing on the stairs, seeing his wife and Levin off. "Yes, yes, Mama wants us, les vous ferez, to attack him," he said, blushing. "But why should I?" "Well, then, I will attack him," said Madame Lvova, with a smile, standing in her round, white dogskin opera cloak, waiting till they had finished speaking. "Come, let us go." Chapter 5. At the concert in the afternoon, two very interesting things were performed. One was a fantasia, King Lear in the Heath. The other was a quartet dedicated to the memory of Bach. Both were new and in the new style, and Levin was eager to form an opinion of them. After escorting his sister-in-law to her stall, he stood against a column and tried to listen as attentively and conscientiously as possible. He tried not to let his attention be distracted and not to spoil his impression by looking at the conductor in a white tie, waving his arms, which always disturbed his enjoyment of music so much, or the ladies in bonnets, the ribbons of which, since it was a concert, they had carefully tied over their ears, and all these people either thinking of nothing at all or thinking of all sorts of things except the music. He tried to avoid meeting musical connoisseurs or talkative acquaintances and stood looking at the floor straight before him, listening. But the more he listened to the fantasia of King Lear, the further he felt from forming any definite opinion of it. There was, as it were, a continual beginning, a preparation of the musical expression of some feeling, but it fell to pieces again directly, breaking into new musical motifs, or simply nothing but the whims of the composer, exceedingly complex but disconnected sounds. And these fragmentary musical expressions, though sometimes beautiful, were disagreeable, because they were utterly unexpected and not led up to by anything. Gaiety and grief and despair and tenderness and triumph followed one another without any ground, like the emotions of a madman. And those emotions, like a madman's, sprang up quite unexpectedly. During the whole performance, Levin felt like a deaf man watching people dancing, and was in a state of complete bewilderment when the fantasia was over, and felt a great weariness from the fruitless strain on his attention. Loud applause resounded on all sides. Everyone got up, moved about, and began talking. Anxious to throw some light on his own perplexity from the impressions of others, Levin began to walk about, looking for connoisseurs, and was glad to see a well-known musical amateur in conversation with Pestsov, whom he knew. Marvelous, Pestsov was saying in his deep bass. How are you, Konstantin Dmitrievich? Particularly sculpturesque and plastic, so to say, and richly colored is that passage where you feel Cordelia's approach, where a woman, Das Ewig Weiblich, enters into conflict with fate, isn't it? You mean, what has Cordelia to do with it? Levin asked timidly, forgetting that the fantasia was supposed to represent King Lear. Cordelia comes in. See, here, said Pestsov, tapping his finger on the satiny surface of the program he held in his hand and passing it to Levin. Only then Levin recollected the title of the fantasia and made haste to read in the Russian translation the lines from Shakespeare that were printed on the back of the program. You can't follow it without that, said Pestsov, addressing Levin as the person he had been speaking to had gone away, and he had no one to talk to. In the intra-act, Levin and Pestsov fell into an argument about the merits and defects of the music of the Wagner school. Levin maintained that the mistake of Wagner and all his followers lay in their trying to take music into the sphere of another art, just as poetry goes wrong when it tries to paint a face, as the art of painting ought to do. And as an instance of this mistake, he cited the sculptor who carved in marble certain poetic phantasms flitting around the figure of the poet on the pedestal. These phantoms were so far from being phantoms that they were positively clinging to the stairs, said Levin. The comparison pleased him, but he could not remember whether he had not used the same phrase before, and to Pestsov, too, and as he said it, he felt confused. Pestsov maintained that art is one and that it can attain its highest manifestations only by the conjunction of all kinds of art. The second piece that was performed, Levin could not hear. Pestsov, who was standing beside him, was talking to him almost all the time, condemning the music for its excessive, affected assumption of simplicity, and comparing it with the simplicity of the pre-Raphaelites in painting. As he went out, Levin met many more acquaintances with whom he talked of politics, of music, and of common acquaintances. Whom he had utterly forgot to call upon. Well, go at once then, Madame Lvova said when he told her. Perhaps they'll not be at home, and then you can come to the meeting to fetch me. You'll find me still there. Chapter 6. Perhaps they're not at home, said Levin as he went into the hall of Countess Bohl's house. At home. Please walk in, said the porter, resolutely removing his overcoat. How annoying, thought Levin, with a sigh, taking off one glove and stroking his hat. What did I come for? What have I to say to them? As he passed through the first drawing room, Levin met in the doorway Countess Bohl, with a careworn and severe face, giving some order to a servant. On seeing Levin, she smiled and asked him to come into the next little drawing room, where he heard voices. In this room, there were sitting in armchairs the two daughters of the Countess and a Moscow colonel, whom Levin knew. Levin walked up, greeted them, and sat down beside the sofa with his hat on his knees. How is your wife? Have you been at the concert? We couldn't go. Mama had to be at the requiem. Yes, I heard. What a sudden death, said Levin. The Countess came in, sat down on the sofa, and she too asked after his wife and inquired about the concert. Levin answered and repeated an inquiry about Madame Aprasina's sudden death. But she was always in poor health. Were you at the opera yesterday? Yes, I was. Luca was very good. Yes, very good, he said. And as it was utterly of no consequence to him what they thought of him, he began repeating what they had heard 100 times about the characteristics of the singer's talent. Countess Bohl pretended to be listening. Then, when he had said enough and had paused, the colonel, who had been silent till then, began to talk. The colonel, too, talked of the opera and illumination. At last, after speaking of the proposed folly journée at the Turins, the colonel laughed, got up noisily, and went away. Levin, too, rose, but he saw by the face of the countess that it was not yet time for him to go. He must stay 2 minutes longer. He sat down. But as he was thinking all the while how stupid it was, He could not find a subject for conversation and sat silent. "You are not going to the public meeting? They say it will be very interesting," began the Countess. "No, I promised my bell sewer to fetch her from it," said Levin. A silence followed. The mother once more exchanged glances with one of the daughters. "Well, now I think the time has come," thought Levin, and he got up. The lady shook hands with him and begged him to say, "Milly chooses to his wife with them." The porter asked him, as he gave him his coat, "Where is your honor staying?" and immediately wrote down his address in a big, handsomely bound book. "Of course I don't care, but still I feel ashamed and awfully stupid," thought Levin, consoling himself with the reflection that everyone does it. He drove to the public meeting where he was to find his sister-in-law, so as to drive home with her. At the public meeting of the committee, there were a great many people and almost all the highest society. Levin was in time for the report, which, as everyone said, was very interesting. When the reading of the report was over, people moved about, and Levin met Sobieski, who invited him very pressuringly to come that evening to a meeting of the Society of Agriculture, where a celebrated report was to be delivered, and Stepan Arkadyevich, who had only just come from the races, and many other acquaintances, and Levin heard and uttered various criticisms on the meeting, on the new play, and on a public trial. But probably from the mental fatigue he was beginning to feel, he made a blunder in speaking of the trial, and this blunder he recalled several times with vexation. Speaking of the sentence upon a foreigner who had been condemned in Russia, and of how unfair it would be to punish him by exile abroad, Levin repeated what he had heard the day before in conversation from an acquaintance. "I think sending him abroad is much the same as punishing a carp by putting him into the water," said Levin. And then he recalled that this idea, which he had heard from an acquaintance and uttered as his own, came from a fable of Krylov's, and that the acquaintance had picked it up from a newspaper article. After driving home with his sister-in-law and finding Kitty in good spirits and quite well, Levin drove to the club. Chapter 7. Levin reached the club just at the right time. Members and visitors were driving up as he arrived. Levin had not been at the club for a very long while, not since he lived in Moscow, when he was leaving the university and going into society. He remembered the club, the external details of its arrangement, but he had completely forgotten the impression it had made on him in old days. But as soon as, driving into the wide semicircular court and getting out of the cab, he mounted the steps, and the hall porter, adorned with a cross belt, noiselessly opened the door to him with a bow. As soon as he saw in the porter's rooms the cloaks and galoshes of members who thought it less trouble to take them off downstairs, as soon as he heard the mysterious ringing bell that preceded him as he ascended the low-stepped, carpeted staircase, and saw the statue on the landing and the third porter at the top doors, a familiar figure grown older in the club livery, opening the door without haste or delay, and scanning the visitors as they passed in. Levin felt the old impression of the club come back in a rush, an impression of repose, comfort, and propriety. "Your hat, please," the porter said to Levin, who forgot the club rule of checking his hat in the porter's room. "Long time since you've been here. The prince put your name down yesterday. Prince Stepan Arkadyevich is not here yet." The porter not only knew Levin, but also all his connections and relationships, and so immediately mentioned his intimate friends. Passing through the outer hall, divided up by screens, and the room partitioned on the right, where a man sits at the fruit buffet, Levin passed by a shuffling old man and entered the dining room, full of noise and people. He walked along the tables, almost all full, and scrutinized the visitors. He saw people of all sorts, old and young. Some he knew a little, some were intimate friends. There was not a single cross or worried-looking face. All seemed to have checked their cares and anxieties in the porter's room with their hats, and were all deliberately getting ready to enjoy the material blessings of life. Sobieski was here, and Shcherbatsky, Nevyedovsky and the old prince, and Vronsky and Sergei Ivanovich. "Ah, why are you late?" the prince said, smiling and giving him his hand over his shoulder. "How's Kitty?" he added, smoothing out the napkin he had tucked in at his waistcoat buttons. Very well. They are dining at home, all three of them. Ah, Aline's, Nadine's, to be sure. There's no room with us. Go to that table and make haste and take a seat, said the prince, and turning away, he carefully took a plate of Fervor soup. Levin, this way. A good-natured voice shouted a little farther on. It was Turovtsin. He was sitting with a young officer, and beside them were two chairs tipped over. Levin gladly went up to them. He had always liked the good-hearted rake, Turovtsin. He was associated in his mind with memories of his courtship, and at that moment, after the strain of intellectual conversation, the sight of Turovtsin's good-natured face was particularly welcome. For you and Oblonsky, he'll be here directly. The young man, holding himself very erect, with eyes forever twinkling with enjoyment, was an officer from Petersburg. Gagin, Turovtsin introduced them. Oblonsky's always late. Ah, here he is. Have you only just come? Said Oblonsky, coming quickly toward them. Good day. Had some vodka? Well, come along then. Levin got up and went with him to the big table spread with spirits and appetizers of the most varied kinds. One would have thought that out of 24 delicacies one might find something to one's taste, but Stepan Arkadyevich asked for something special, and one of the liveried waiters standing by immediately brought what was required. They drank a pony each and returned to their table. At once, while they were still at their soup, Gagin was served with champagne and told the waiter to fill four glasses. Levin did not refuse the wine and asked for a second bottle. He was very hungry and ate and drank with great enjoyment, and with still greater enjoyment took part in the lively and simple conversation of his companions. Gagin, drafting his voice, told the last good story from Petersburg, and the story, though improper and stupid, was so ludicrous that Levin broke into roars of laughter, so loud that those near looked round. That's in the same style as, that's a thing I can't endure. You know the story, said Stepan Arkadyevich. Ah, that's exquisite. Another bottle, he said to the waiter, and he began to relate his good story. Peter Ilyich Vinovsky invites you to drink with him. A little old waiter interrupted Stepan Arkadyevich, bringing two delicate glasses of sparkling champagne and addressing Stepan Arkadyevich and Levin. Stepan Arkadyevich took the glass, and looking toward a bald man with red mustaches at the other end of the table, he nodded to him, smiling. Who's that? Asked Levin. You met him once at my place, don't you remember? A good-natured fellow. Levin did the same as Stepan Arkadyevich and took the glass. Stepan Arkadyevich's anecdote, too, was very amusing. Levin told his story, and that, too, was successful. Then they talked of horses, of the races, of what they had been doing that day, and of how smartly Vronsky's Atlas had won the first prize. Levin did not notice how the time passed at dinner. Ah, and here they are, Stepan Arkadyevich said toward the end of dinner, leaning over the back of his chair and holding out his hand to Vronsky, who came up with the tall colonel of the guards. Vronsky's face, too, beamed with the look of good-humored enjoyment that was general in the club. He propped his elbow playfully on Stepan Arkadyevich's shoulder, whispering something to him, and he held out his hand to Levin with the same good-humored smile. Very glad to meet you, he said. I looked out for you at the election, but I was told you had gone away. Yes, I left the same day. We've just been talking of your horse. I congratulate you, said Levin. It was run in very fast time. Yes, you've raised horses too, haven't you? No, my father had. But I remember and know something about them. Where have you dined? Asked Stepan Arkadyevich. We were at the second table behind the columns. We've been celebrating his success, said the tall colonel. It's his second imperial prize. I wish I might have the luck at cards he has with horses. Well, why waste precious time? I'm going to the infernal regions, added the colonel, and he walked away. That's Iashvin, Vronsky said in answer to Turovtsin, and he sat down in the vacated seat behind them. He drank the glass offered to him and ordered a bottle of wine. Under the influence of the club atmosphere or the wine he had drunk, Levin chatted away to Vronsky of the best breeds of cattle and was very glad not to feel the slightest hostility to this man. He even told him, among other things, that he had heard from his wife and that she had met him at Princess Maria Borisovna's. "Ah, Princess Maria Borisovna, she's exquisite," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, and he told an anecdote about her which set them all laughing. Vronsky in particular laughed with such simple-hearted amusement that Levin felt quite reconciled to him. "Well, have we finished?" said Stepan Arkadyevitch, getting up with a smile. "Let's go." Chapter 8. Getting up from the table, Levin walked with Gagin through the lofty rooms to the billiard room, feeling his arms swing as he walked with a peculiar lightness and ease. As he crossed the big room, he came upon his father-in-law. "Well, how do you like our temple of indolence?" said the prince, taking his arm. "Come along, come along." "Yes, I wanted to walk about and look at everything. It's interesting." "Yes, it's interesting for you. But its interest for me is quite different." "You look at little ancients now," he said, pointing to a club member with bent back and pendulous lips shuffling toward them in his soft boots, "and imagine that they were Shlupiks like that from their birth up." "Shlupiks? I see you don't know that name. That's our club designation. You know the game of rolling eggs? When one's rolled a long while, it becomes a Shlupik. So it is with us. One goes on coming and coming to the club and ends up becoming a Shlupik." "Ah, you laugh, but we look out for fear of dropping into it ourselves. You know Prince Chechensky?" inquired the prince, and Levin saw his face that he was going to relate something funny. "No, I don't know him." "You don't say so. Well, Prince Chechensky is a well-known figure. No matter, though. He's always playing billiards here. Only 3 years ago, he was not a Shlupik, and kept up his spirits, and even used to call other people Shlupiks. But one day he turns up, and our porter, you know Vasily? Why, that fat one, he's famous for his bon mots. And so Prince Chechensky asks him, 'Come, Vasily, who's here? Any Shlupiks here yet?' And he says, 'You're the third.' 'Yes, my dear boy, that he did.'" Talking and greeting the friends they met, Levin and the prince walked through all the rooms, the great room where tables had already been set, and the usual partners were playing for small stakes, the divan room where they were playing chess, and Sergei Ivanovich was sitting talking to somebody, the billiard room where, about the sofa in a recess, there was a lively party drinking champagne. Gagin was one of them. They peeped into the infernal regions, where a good many men were crowding around one table at which Pyashvin was sitting. Trying not to make a noise, they walked into the dark reading room, where, under the shaded lamps, there sat a young man with a wrathful countenance, turning over one journal after another, and a bald general buried in a book. They went, too, into what the prince called the intellectual room, where three gentlemen were engaged in a heated discussion of the latest political news. "Prince, please come, we're ready," said one of his card party, who had come to look for him. And the prince went off. Levin sat down and listened, but recalling all the conversation of the morning, he felt all of a sudden fearfully bored. He got up hurriedly and went to look for Oblonsky and Turovtsin, with whom it had been so pleasant. Turovtsin was one of the circle drinking in the billiard room, and Stepan Arkadyevitch was talking with Vronsky near the door at the farther corner of the room. "It's not that she's dull, but this undefined, this unsettled position," Levin caught, and he was going to hurry away, but Stepan Arkadyevitch called him. "Levin," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, and Levin noticed that his eyes were not full of tears exactly, but moist, which always happened when he had been drinking or when he was touched. Today it was due to both causes. "Levin, don't go," he said, and he warmly squeezed his arm above the elbow, obviously not at all wishing to let him go. "This is a true friend of mine, almost my greatest friend," he said to Vronsky. "You also are still closer and dearer to me, and I want you, and I know you ought to be friends, and great friends, because you're both splendid fellows." "Well, there's nothing for us now but to kiss and be friends," Vronsky said, with good-natured playfulness, holding out his hand. Levin quickly took the offered hand and squeezed it warmly. "I'm very, very glad," said Levin. Waiter, a bottle of champagne, said Stepan Arkadyevich. And I'm very glad, said Vronsky. But in spite of Stepan Arkadyevich's desire and their own desire, they had nothing to talk about, and both felt it. Do you know he has never met Anna? Stepan Arkadyevich said to Vronsky. And I want about everything to take him to see her. Let us go, Levin. Really? Said Vronsky. She will be very glad to see you. I should be going home at once, he added, but I'm worried about Yashvin, and I want to stay on till he finishes. Why is he losing? He keeps losing, and I'm the only friend that can restrain him. Well, what do you say to pyramids? Levin, will you play? Capital, said Stepan Arkadyevich. Get the table ready, he said to the marker. It has been ready a long while, answered the marker, who had already set the balls in a triangle and was knocking the red one about for his own diversion. Well, let's begin. After the game, Vronsky and Levin sat down at Gagin's table, and at Stepan Arkadyevich's suggestion, Levin took a hand in the game. Vronsky sat down at the table surrounded by friends who were incessantly coming up to him. Every now and then he went to the Inferno to keep an eye on Yashvin. Levin was enjoying a delightful sense of repose after the mental fatigue of the morning. He was glad that all hostility was at an end with Vronsky, and the sense of peace, decorum, and comfort never left him. When the game was over, Stepan Arkadyevich took Levin's arm. Well, let us go to Anna's then. At once? Hey, she is at home. I promised her long ago to bring you. Where were you intending to spend the evening? Oh, nowhere especially. I promised Ivyasky to go to the Society of Agriculture. By all means, let us go, said Levin. Very good, come along. Find out if my carriage is here, said Stepan Arkadyevich to the waiter. Levin went up to the table, paid the 40 rubles he had lost, paid his bill, the amount of which was in some mysterious way ascertained by the little old waiter who stood at the counter, and swinging his arms, he walked through all the rooms to the exit. Chapter 9. Oblonsky's carriage, the porter shouted in an angry bass. The carriage drove up and both got in. It was only for the first few moments, while the carriage was driving out of the clubhouse gates, that Levin was still under the influence of the club atmosphere of repose, comfort, and unimpeachable good form. But as soon as the carriage drove out into the street and he felt it jolting over the uneven road, heard the angry shout of a driver coming toward them, saw in the uncertain light the red blind of a tavern and the shops, this impression was dissipated, and he began to think over his actions and to wonder whether he was doing right in going to see Anna. What would Kitty say? But Stepan Arkadyevich gave him no time for reflection, and as though divining his doubts, he dispersed them. How glad I am, he said, that you should know her. You know, Dolly has long wished for it. And Lvov's been to see her, and often goes, though she is my sister, Stepan Arkadyevich pursued. I don't hesitate to say that she's a remarkable woman, but you will see, her position is very painful, especially now. Why especially now? We are carrying on negotiations with her husband about a divorce, and he's agreed, but there are difficulties in regard to the son, and the business, which ought to have been arranged long ago, has been dragging on for 3 months past. As soon as the divorce is over, she will marry Vronsky. How stupid these old ritual forms are. Isaiah, rejoice, which no one believes in and which only prevent people being uncomfortable, Stepan Arkadyevich put in. Well, then, their position will be as regular as mine, as yours. What is the difficulty, said Levin. Oh, it's a long and tedious story. The whole business is in such an indefinite state with us. But the point is, she has been for 3 months in Moscow, where everyone knows her, waiting for the divorce. She goes out nowhere, sees no woman except Dolly, because, do you understand, she doesn't care to have people come as a favor. That fool, Princess Varvara, even she has left her, considering this a breach of propriety. Well, you see, in such a position, any other woman would not have found resources in herself. But you'll see how she has arranged her life, how calm, how dignified she is. To the left in the alley opposite the church, shouted Stepan Arkadyevich, leaning out of the window of the carriage. Phew, how hot it is, he said, in spite of 12 degrees of frost, flinging open his unbuttoned overcoat still more. But she has a daughter. No doubt she's busy looking after her, said Levin. I believe you picture every woman simply as a female, un convius, said Stepan Arkadyevich. If she occupied, it must be with her children. No, she brings her up capitally. I believe, but one doesn't hear about her. She's busy in the first place with what she writes. I see you're smiling ironically, but you're wrong. She's writing a children's book and doesn't talk about it to anyone. But she read it to me, and I gave the manuscript to Vorku, you know, the publisher, and he's an author himself, too, I fancy. He understands those things, and he says it's a remarkable piece of work. But are you fancying she's a writing woman? Not a bit of it. She's a woman with a heart before everything, but you'll see. Now she has a little English girl with her and a whole family she's looking after. Oh, something in a philanthropic way. Why, you will look at everything in the worst light. It's not from philanthropy, it's from the heart. They, that is, Vronsky and a trainer, an Englishman, first rate in his own line, but a drunkard. He's completely given up to drink, delirium tremens, and the family were cast on the world. She saw them, helped them, got more and more interested in them, and now the whole family is on her hands. But not by way of patronage, you know, helping with money. She's herself preparing the boys in Russia for the high school, and she's taken the little girl to live with her. But you'll see her for yourself. The carriage drove into the courtyard, and Stepan Arkadyevich rang loudly at the entrance where a sleigh was standing. And without asking the servant who opened the door whether the lady were at home, Stepan Arkadyevich walked into the hall. Levin followed him, more and more doubtful whether he was doing right or wrong. Looking at himself in the glass, Levin noticed that he was red in the face, but he felt certain he was not drunk, and he followed Stepan Arkadyevich up the carpeted stairs. At the top, Stepan Arkadyevich inquired of the footman, who bowed to him as to an intimate friend, who was with Anna Arkadyevna and received no answer, that it was Mr. Vorku. Where are they? In the study. Passing through the dining room, a room not very large with dark paneled walls, Stepan Arkadyevich and Levin walked over the soft carpet to the half-dark study, lighted up by a single lamp with a big dark shade. Another lamp with a reflector was hanging on the wall, lighting up a big full-length portrait of a woman, which Levin could not help looking at. It was the portrait of Anna, painted in Italy, by Mikhailov. While Stepan Arkadyevich went behind the trilliage and the man's voice, which had been speaking, paused, Levin gazed at the portrait, which stood out from the frame in the brilliant light brown on it, and could not tear himself away from it. He positively forgot where he was, and not even hearing what was said, he could not take his eyes off the marvelous portrait. It was not a picture, but a living, charming woman with black curling hair, with bare arms and shoulders, with a pensive smile on her lips, covered with soft down. Triumphantly and softly, she looked at him with eyes that baffled him. She was not living, only because she was more beautiful than any living woman can be. Suddenly near him, a voice, unmistakably addressing him, the voice of the very woman he had been admiring in the portrait. Anna had come from behind the trilliage to meet him, and Levin saw in the dim light of the study the very woman of the portrait, in a dark blue gown of changeable blue, not in the same position nor with the same expression, but with the same perfection of beauty which the artist had caught in the portrait. She was less dazzling in reality, but, on the other hand, there was something fresh and seductive in the living woman which was not in the portrait. Chapter 10. She had risen to meet him without concealing her pleasure at seeing him, and in the quiet ease with which she held out her little and vigorous hand, introduced him to Vorku, and indicated a red-haired, pretty little girl who was sitting at work, calling her pupil. Levin recognized and liked the manners of a woman of the world, always self-possessed and natural. I am delighted, delighted, she repeated, and on her lips these simple words took for Levin's ears a special significance. I have known you and liked you for a long while, both from your friendship with Stiva and for your wife's sake. I knew her for a very short time, but she left on me the impression of an exquisite flower, just a flower, and to think she will soon be a mother. She spoke easily and without haste, looking now and then from Levin to her brother, and Levin felt that the impression he was making was good, and he felt immediately at home, at ease, and happy with her, as though he had known her from childhood. "Ivan Petrovich and I settled in Alexei's study," she said in answer to Stepan Arkadyevich's question whether he might smoke, just so as to be able to smoke. And glancing at Levin, instead of asking whether he would smoke, she pulled closer a tortoiseshell cigarette case and took a corn-leaf cigarette. "How are you feeling today?" her brother asked her. "Oh, nothing. Nerves as usual." "Yes, isn't it extraordinarily fine?" said Stepan Arkadyevich, noticing that Levin was glancing at the picture. "I have never seen a better portrait." "And extraordinarily like, isn't it?" said Vorkyev. Levin looked from the portrait to the original. A peculiar brilliance lighted up Anna's face when she felt his eyes on her. Levin flushed, and to cover his confusion, would have asked whether she had seen Darya Alexandrovna lately. But at that moment Anna spoke. "We were just talking, Ivan Petrovich and I, of Vashchenkov's last pictures. Have you seen them?" "Yes, I have seen them," answered Levin. "But I beg your pardon, I interrupted you. You were saying..." Levin asked if she had seen Dolly lately. "She was here yesterday. She was very indignant with the high school people on Grisha's account. The Latin teacher, it seems, had been unfair to him." "Yes, I have seen his pictures. I didn't care for them very much." Levin went back to the subject she had started. Levin talked now, not at all with that purely businesslike attitude to the subject with which he had been talking all the morning. Every word in his conversation with her had a special significance. And talking to her was pleasant. Still pleasanter was it to listen to her. Anna talked not merely naturally and cleverly, but cleverly and carelessly, attaching no value to her own ideas and giving great weight to the ideas of the person she was talking to. The conversation turned on the new movement in art, on the new illustrations of the Bible by a French artist. Vorkyev attacked the artist for a realism carried to the point of coarseness. Levin said that the French had carried conventionality further than anyone, and that consequently they see a great merit in the return to realism. In the fact of not lying, they see poetry. Never had anything clever said by Levin given him so much pleasure as this remark. Anna's face lighted up at once as she immediately appreciated the thought. She laughed. "I laugh," she said, "as one laughs when one sees a very true portrait. What you said so perfectly hits off French art now. Painting and literature, too, indeed. Zola, Daudet. But perhaps it was always so, that men form their conceptions from fictitious conventional types, and then, all the combinations made, they are tired of the fictitious figures and begin to invent more natural, true figures." "That's perfectly true," said Vorkyev. "So you've been at the club," she said to her brother. "Yes, yes, this a woman," Levin thought, forgetting himself and staring persistently at her lovely mobile face, which at that moment was all at once completely transformed. Levin did not hear what she was talking of as she leaned over to her brother, but he was struck by the change of her expression. Her face, so handsome a moment before in its repose, suddenly wore a look of strange curiosity, anger, and pride. But this lasted only an instant. She half closed her eyes as though recollecting something. "Oh, well, but that's of no interest to anyone," she said, and she turned to the English girl. "Please order the tea in the drawing room," she said in English. The girl got up and went out. "Well, how did she get through her examination?" asked Stepan Arkadyevich. "Splendidly. She's a very gifted child and a sweet character. It will end in your loving her more than your own." "There, a man speaks. In love, there's no such thing as more or less. I love my daughter with one love, and her with another." "I was just telling Anna Arkadyevna," said Vorkyev, "that if she were to put 1/100th part of the energy she devotes to this English girl, to the public question of the education of Russian children, she would be doing a great and useful work." "Yes, but I can't help it. I couldn't do it. Count Alexei Kirillovich urged me very much. As she uttered the words, Count Alexei Kirillovich, she glanced with a feeling timidity at Levin, and he unconsciously responded with a respectful and reassuring look. He urged me to take up the school in the village. I visited it several times. The children were very dear, but I could not feel drawn to the work. You speak of energy. Energy rests upon love, and come as it will, there's no forcing it. I took to this child. I could not myself say why. And she glanced again at Levin, and her smile and her glance all told him that it was to him only she was addressing her words, valuing his good opinion and at the same time sure beforehand that they understood one another. I quite understand that, Levin answered. It's impossible to give one's heart to a school or such institutions in general, and I believe that that's why philanthropic institutions always give such poor results. She was silent for a while, and then she smiled. Yes, yes, she agreed, I never could. Je n'ai pas le cœur assez large to love a whole asylum of horrid little girls. Cela n'a jamais réussi. There are so many women who have made themselves une position sociale in that way. And now, more than ever, she said with a mournful, confiding expression, ostensibly addressing her brother, but unmistakably intending her words only for Levin, now when I have such need of some occupation, I cannot. And suddenly frowning, Levin saw that she was frowning at herself for talking about herself. She changed the subject. I know about you, she said to Levin, that you're not a public-spirited citizen, and I have defended you to the best of my ability. How have you defended me? Oh, according to the attacks made on you. But won't you have some tea? She rose and took up a book bound in Morocco. Give it to me, Anna Arkadyevna, said Vorkuv, indicating the book. It's well worth taking up. Oh, no, it's also sketchy. I told him about it, Stepan Arkadyevich said to his sister, nodding at Levin. You shouldn't have. My writing is something after the fashion of those little baskets and carvings which Lisa Mertzalova used to sell me from the prisons. She had the direction of the prison department in that society, she turned to Levin, and they were miracles of patience, the work of those poor wretches. And Levin saw a new trait in this woman, who attracted him so extraordinarily. Besides wit and grace and beauty, she had truth. She had no wish to hide from him all the bitterness of her position. As she said that, she sighed, and her face, suddenly assuming a hard expression, looked, as it were, turned to stone. With that expression on her face, she was more beautiful than ever, but the expression was new. It was utterly unlike that expression, radiant with happiness and creating happiness, which had been caught by the painter in her portrait. Levin looked more than once at the portrait and at her figure. As taking her brother's arm, she walked with him to the high doors, and he felt for her a tenderness and pity at which he wondered himself. She asked Levin and Vorkuv to go into the drawing room while she stayed behind to say a few words to her brother. About her divorce, about Vronsky and what he's doing at the club, about me, wondered Levin. And he was so keenly interested by the question of what she was saying to Stepan Arkadyevich that he scarcely heard what Vorkuv was telling him of the qualities of the story for children Anna Arkadyevna had written. At tea, the same pleasant sort of talk, full of interesting matter, continued. There was not a single instant when a subject for conversation was to seek. On the contrary, it was felt that one had hardly time to say what one had to say, and eagerly held back to hear what the others were saying. And all that was said, not only by her, but by Vorkuv and Stepan Arkadyevich, all, so it seemed to Levin, gained peculiar significance from her attention to him and her criticism. While he followed this interesting conversation, Levin was all the time admiring her, her beauty, her intelligence, her culture, and at the same time her directness and her cordiality. He listened and talked, and all the while he was thinking of her inner life, trying to divine her feelings. And though he had judged her so severely hitherto, now, by some strange chain of reasoning, he was justifying her, and also was sorry for her, and afraid that Vronsky did not fully understand her. At 10 o'clock, when Stepan Arkadyevich got up to go, Vorkuv had left earlier, it seemed to Levin that he had only just come. Regretfully, Levin rose too. Goodbye, she said, holding his hand and glancing into his face with a winning look. I am very qui de glace es rompu. She dropped his hand and half closed her eyes. Tell your wife that I love her as before, and that if she cannot pardon me my position, then my wish for her is that she may never pardon me. To pardon it, one must go through what I have gone through, and may God spare her that. Certainly, yes, I will tell her, Levin said, blushing. Chapter 11. What a marvelous, sweet, and unhappy woman, he was thinking as he stepped out into the frosty air with Stepan Arkadyevich. Well, didn't I tell you, said Stepan Arkadyevich, seeing that Levin had been completely won over. Yes, said Levin pensively, an extraordinary woman. It's not her cleverness, but she has such wonderful depth of feeling. I'm awfully sorry for her. Now, please God, everything will soon be settled. Well, well, don't be hard on people in future, said Stepan Arkadyevich, opening the carriage door. Goodbye. We don't go the same way. Still thinking of Anna, of everything, even the simplest phrase in their conversation with her, and recalling the minutest changes in her expression, entering more and more into her position and feeling sympathy for her, Levin reached home. At home, Kuzma told Levin that Katerina Alexandrovna was quite well, that her sisters had just gone, and he handed him two letters. Levin read them at once in the hall that he might not overlook them later. One was from Sokolov, his bailiff. Sokolov wrote that the wheat could not be sold, that the price was only 5.5 rubles, and that he did not know where he had to get the money. The other letter was from his sister. She scolded him for her business being still unsettled. Well, we must sell it at 5.5 if we can't get more, Levin decided on the spot the first question, which as always before seemed such a weighty one, with extraordinary facility. It's extraordinary how all one's time is taken up here, he thought, considering the second letter. He felt himself to blame for not having got done what his sister had asked him to do for her. Today, again, I've not been to court, but today I've certainly not had time. And resolving that he would not fail to do it next day, he went up to his wife. As he went in, Levin mentally ran rapidly through the day he had spent. All the events of the day were conversations, conversations he had heard and taken part in. All the conversations were upon subjects which, if he had been alone in the country, he would never have taken up, but here they were very interesting. And all these conversations were right enough, only in two places there was something not quite right. One was what he had said about the car, the other was something not quite the thing in the tender sympathy he was feeling for Anna. Levin found his wife low-spirited and dull. The dinner of the three sisters had gone off very well, but then they had waited and waited for him. All of them had felt dull, and the sisters had departed, and she had been left alone. Well, and what have you been doing? She asked him, looking straight into his eyes, which shone with rather a suspicious brightness. But that she might not prevent his telling her everything, she concealed her close scrutiny of him, and with an approving smile listened to his account of how he had spent the evening. Well, I am very glad I met Vronsky. I felt quite at ease and natural with him. You understand, I shall try not to see him, but I'm glad that this awkwardness is all over, he said. And remembering that, by way of trying not to see him, he had immediately gone to call on Anna, he blushed. We talk about the peasants drinking. I don't know who drinks most, the peasantry or our own class. The peasants do it on holidays, but Kitty took not the slightest interest in discussing the drinking habits of the peasants. She saw that he blushed, and she wanted to know why. Well, and then where did you go? Stiver urged me awfully to go and see Anna Arkadyevna. And as he said this, Levin blushed even more, and his doubts as to whether he had done right in going to see Anna were settled once and for all. He knew now that he had not to have done so. Kitty's eyes opened in a curious way and gleamed at Anna's name, but controlling herself with an effort, she concealed her emotion and deceived him. Oh, was all she said. I'm sure you won't be angry at my going. Stiva begged me to, and Dolly wished it, Levin went on. Oh, no, she said, but he saw in her eyes a constraint that boded him no good. She is a very sweet, a very, very unhappy, good woman, he said, telling her about Anna, her occupations, and what she had told him to say to her. Yes, of course, she is very much to be pitied, said Kitty, when he had finished. Whom was your letter from? He told her, and believing in her calm tone, he went to change his coat. Coming back, he found Kitty in the same easy chair. When he went up to her, she glanced at him and broke into sobs. "What? What is it?" he asked, knowing beforehand what. "You're in love with that hateful woman. She has bewitched you. I saw it in your eyes. Yes, yes. What can it all lead to? You were drinking at the club, drinking and gambling, and then you went..." "Where?" "No, we must go away. I shall go away tomorrow." It was a long while before Levin could soothe his wife. At last he succeeded in calming her, only by confessing that a feeling of pity, in conjunction with the wine he had drunk, had been too much for him, that he had succumbed to Anna's artful influence, and that he would avoid her. One thing he did with more sincerity confess to was that living so long in Moscow, a life of nothing but conversation, eating and drinking, he was growing crazy. They talked till 3 o'clock in the morning. Only at 3 were they sufficiently reconciled to be able to go to sleep. Chapter 12. After taking leave of her guests, Anna did not sit down but began walking up and down the room. She had unconsciously the whole evening done her utmost to arouse in Levin a feeling of love, as of late she had fallen into doing with all young men, and she knew she had attained her aim as far as was possible in one evening with a married and conscientious man. She liked him very much indeed, and in spite of the striking difference from the masculine point of view between Vronsky and Levin, as a woman she saw something they had in common, which had made Kitty able to love both. Yet as soon as he was out of the room, she ceased to think of him. One thought, and one only, pursued her in different forms and refused to be shaken off. "If I have so much effect on others, on this man who loves his home and his wife, why is it he is so cold to me?" "Not cold, exactly. He loves me, I know that. But something new is drawing us apart now. Why wasn't he here all the evening? He told Stiva to say he could not leave Yashvin and must watch over his play. Is Yashvin a child? But supposing it's true, he never tells a lie. But there's something else in it if it's true. He is glad of an opportunity of showing me that he has other duties. I know that, I submit to that. But why prove that to me? He wants to show me that his love for me is not to interfere with his freedom. But I need no proofs, I need love. He ought to understand all the bitterness of this life for me here in Moscow. Is this life? I am not living, but waiting for an event which is continually put off and put off. No answer again. And Stiva says he cannot go to Alexei Alexandrovich. And I can't write again. I can do nothing, can begin nothing, can alter nothing. I hold myself in. I wait, inventing amusement for myself, the English family, writing, reading. But it's all nothing but a sham. It's all the same as morphine. He ought to feel for me, she said, feeling tears of self-pity coming into her eyes. She heard Vronsky's abrupt ring and hurriedly dried her tears, not only dried her tears, but sat down by a lamp and opened a book, affecting composure. She wanted to show him that she was displeased that he had not come home as he had promised, displeased only, and not on any account to let him see her distress, and least of all her self-pity. She might pity herself, but he must not pity her. She did not want strife. She blamed him for wanting to quarrel, but unconsciously put herself into an attitude of antagonism. "Well, you've not been dull," he said, eagerly and good-humoredly going up to her. "What a terrible passion it is, gambling." "No, I've not been dull. I've learned long ago not to be dull. Stiva has been here, and Levin." "Yes, they meant to come and see you." "Well, how did you like Levin?" he said, sitting down beside her. "Very much. They have not been gone long. What was Yashvin doing?" "He was winning 17,000. I got him away. He had already started home, but he went back again, and now he's losing." "Then what did you stay for?" she asked, suddenly lifting her eyes to him. The expression of her face was cold and ungracious. "You told Stiver you were staying on to get Yashvin away, and you have left him there?" The same expression of cold readiness for the conflict appeared on his face, too. "In the first place, I did not ask him to give you any message, and secondly, I never tell lies. But the chief point is, I wanted to stay, and I stayed," he said, frowning. "Anna, what is it for? Why will you do this?" he said after a moment's silence, bending over toward her, and he opened his hand, hoping she would lay hers in it. She was glad of this appeal for tenderness, but some strange force of evil would not let her give herself up to her feelings, as though the rules of warfare would not prevent her to surrender. Of course you wanted to stay, and you stayed. You do everything you want to. But what do you tell me that for? With what object, she said, getting more and more excited. Does anyone contest your rights? But you want to be right, and you're welcome to be right. His hand closed, he turned away, and his face wore a still more obstinate expression. For you, it's a matter of obstinacy, she said, watching him intently, and suddenly finding the right word for that expression that irritated her. Simply obstinacy. For you, it's a question of whether you keep the upper hand for me, while for me, again she felt sorry for herself, and she almost burst into tears. If you knew what it is for me, when I feel as I do now, that you are hostile, yes, hostile to me, if you knew what this means for me, if you knew how I feel on the brink of calamity at this instant, how afraid I am of myself, and she turned away, hiding her sobs. But what are you talking about, he said, horrified at her expression of despair, and again bending over her, he took her hand and kissed it. What is it for? Do I seek amusements outside our home? Don't I avoid the society of women? Well, yes, if that were all, she said. Come, tell me what I ought to do to give you peace of mind. I am ready to do anything to make you happy, he said, touched by her expression of despair. What wouldn't I do to save you from distress of any sort, as now, Anna, he said. It's nothing, nothing, she said. I don't know myself whether it's the solitary life, my nerves. Come, don't let us talk of it. What about the race? You haven't told me, she inquired, trying to conceal her triumph at the victory, which had been on her side after all. He asked for supper and began telling her about the races, but in his tone, in his eyes, which became more and more cold, she saw that he did not forgive her for her victory, that the feeling of obstinacy with which she had been struggling had asserted itself again in him. He was colder to her than before, as though he were regretting his surrender. And she, remembering the words that had given her the victory, how I feel on the brink of calamity, how afraid I am of myself, saw that this weapon was a dangerous one, and that it could not be used a second time. And she felt that beside the love that bound them together, there was grown up between them some evil spirit of strife, which she could not exorcise from his heart, and still less from her own. Chapter 13. There are no conditions to which a man cannot become used, especially if he sees that all around him are living in the same way. Levin could not have believed 3 months before that he could have gone quietly to sleep in the state in which he was that day, that leading an aimless, irrational life, also living beyond his means, after drinking to excess, he could not call what happened at the club anything else, forming inappropriately friendly relations with a man with whom his wife had once been in love, and after a still more inappropriate call upon a woman who could only be called a lost woman, after being fascinated by that woman and causing his wife distress, he could still go quietly to sleep. But under the influence of fatigue, a sleepless night, and the wine he had drunk, his sleep was sound and untroubled. At 5 o'clock, the creak of a door opening waked him. He jumped up and looked round. Kitty was not in bed beside him, but there was a light moving behind the screen, and he heard her steps. What is it? What is it? He said, half asleep. Kitty, what is it? Nothing, she said, coming from behind the screen with a candle in her hand. I felt unwell, she said, smiling a particularly sweet and meaning smile. What? Has it begun? He said in terror. We ought to send, and hurriedly he reached after his clothes. No, no, she said, smiling and holding his hand. It's sure to be nothing. I was rather unwell, only a little. It's all over now. And getting into bed, she blew out the candle, lay down, and was still. Though he thought her stillness suspicious, as though she were holding her breath, and still more suspicious the expression of peculiar tenderness and excitement with which, as she came from behind the screen, she had said nothing, he was so sleepy that he fell asleep at once. Only later he remembered the stillness of her breathing and understood all that must have been passing in her sweet, precious heart while she lay beside him, not stirring, in anticipation of the greatest event in a woman's life. At 7 o'clock, he was waked by the touch of her hand on his shoulder and a gentle whisper. She seemed struggling between regret at waking him and the desires to talk to him. "Kostya, don't be frightened. It's all right. But I fancy we ought to send for Lizaveta Petrovna." The candle was lighted again. She was sitting up in bed, holding some knitting, which she had been busy upon during the last few days. "Please don't be frightened. It's all right." "I'm not a bit afraid," she said, seeing his scared face, and she pressed his hand to her bosom and then to her lips. He hurriedly jumped up, hardly awake, and kept his eyes fixed on her as he put on his dressing gown. Then he stopped, still looking at her. He had to go, but he could not tear himself away from her eyes. He thought he loved her face, knew her expression, her eyes, but never had he seen it like this. How hateful and horrible he seemed to himself, thinking of this distress he had caused her yesterday. Her flushed face, fringed with soft curling hair under her nightcap, was radiant with joy and courage. Though there was so little that was artificial or pretend in Kitty's character in general, Levin was struck by what was revealed now, when suddenly all disguises were thrown off and the very kernel of her soul shone in his eyes. And in this simplicity and nakedness of her soul, she, the very woman he loved in her, was more manifest than ever. She looked at him smiling, but all at once her brows twitched. She threw up her head and, going quickly up to him, clutched his hand and pressed close up to him, breathing her hot breath upon him. She was in pain and was, as it were, complaining to him of her suffering. And for the first minute, from habit, it seemed to him that he was to blame. But in her eyes there was a tenderness that told him she was far from reproaching him, that she loved him for her sufferings. "If not I, who is to blame for it?" he thought unconsciously, seeking someone responsible for this suffering for him to punish. But there was no one responsible. She was suffering, complaining, and triumphing in her sufferings, and rejoicing in them, and loving them. He saw that something sublime was being accomplished in her soul, but what? He could not make it out. It was beyond his understanding. "I have sent to Mama. You go quickly to fetch Lizaveta Petrovna, Kostya. Never mind. It's over." She moved away from him and rang the bell. "Well, go now. Pasha's coming. I am all right." And Levin saw with astonishment that she had taken up the knitting she had brought in the night and had begun working at it again. As Levin was going out of one door, he heard the maidservant come in at another. He stood at the door and heard Kitty giving exact directions to the maid and beginning to help her move the bedstead. He dressed, and while they were putting in his horse, as there were no hacks about as yet, he ran again up to the bedroom, not on tiptoe, it seemed to him, but on wings. Two maidservants were carefully shifting something about in the bedroom. Kitty was walking about, knitting rapidly and giving directions. "I'm going for the doctor. They have sent for Lizaveta Petrovna, but I'll go on there, too. Isn't there anything wanted?" "Yes. Shall I go to Dolly's?" She looked at him, obviously not hearing what he was saying. "Yes, yes, do go," she said quickly, frowning and waving her hand to him. He had just gone into the drawing room when suddenly a plaintive moan sounded from the bedroom, smothered instantly. He stood still, and for a long while he could not understand. "Yes, that is she," he said to himself, and clutching at his head, he ran downstairs. "Lord have mercy on us, forgive us, help us," he repeated the words that for some reason came suddenly to his lips. And he, an unbeliever, repeated these words not with his lips only. At that instant he knew that all his doubts, even the impossibility of believing with his reason, of which he was aware in himself, did not in the least hinder his turning to God. All of that now floated out of his soul like dust. To whom was he to turn if not to him in whose hands he felt himself, his soul and his love? The horse was not yet ready, but feeling a peculiar concentration of his physical forces and his intellect on what he had to do, he, losing no minute, started off on foot without waiting for the horse and told Kuzma to overtake him. At the corner he met a night hack driving hurriedly. In the little sleigh, wrapped in a velvet cloak, sat Lizaveta Petrovna with a kerchief round her head. "Thank God, thank God," he said, overjoyed to recognize her little fair face, which wore a peculiarly serious, even stern expression. Telling the driver not to stop, he ran along beside her. For 2 hours, then? Not more? She inquired. You should let Peter Dmitrievich know, but don't hurry him, and get some opium at the chemist's. So you think that it will go well? Lord have mercy on us and help us, Levin said, seeing his own horse driving out of the gate. Jumping into the sleigh beside Kuzma, he told him to drive to the doctor's. Chapter 14. The doctor was not yet up, and the footman said that he had been up late and had given orders not to be waked, but would get up soon. The footman was cleaning the lamp chimneys and seemed very busy about them. This concentration of the footman upon his lamps and his indifference to what was passing in Levin at first astounded him, but immediately on considering the question he realized that no one knew or was bound to know his feelings, and that it was all the more necessary to act calmly, sensibly, and resolutely to get through this wall of indifference and attain his aim. Don't be in a hurry or let anything slip, Levin said to himself, feeling a greater and greater flow of physical energy and attention to all he had yet to do. Having ascertained that the doctor was not getting up, Levin considered various plans, and decided on the following one, that Kuzma should go for another doctor, while he himself should go to the chemist for opium. And if, when he came back, the doctor had not yet begun to get up, he would, either by tipping the footman or by force, wake the doctor at all hazards. At the chemist, the lank pharmacist wafered a packet of powders for a coachman who stood waiting, and refused him opium with the same callousness with which the doctor's footman had cleaned his lamp chimneys. Trying not to get flustered or out of temper, Levin mentioned the names of the doctor and midwife, and explaining what the opium was needed for, tried to persuade him. The assistant inquired in German whether he should give it, and receiving an affirmative reply from behind the partition, he took out a bottle and a funnel, deliberately poured the opium from a bigger bottle into a little one, stuck on a label, sealed it up, in spite of Levin's request that he would not do so, and was about to wrap it up too. This was more than Levin could stand. He took the bottle firmly out of his hands and ran to the big glass door. The doctor was not even now getting up, and the footman, busy now and putting down the rugs, refused to wake him. Levin deliberately took out a 10-ruble note, and careful to speak slowly, though losing no time over the business, he handed him the note and explained that Peter Dmitrievich, what a great and important personage he seemed to Levin now, this Peter Dmitrievich, who had been of so little consequence in his eyes before, had promised to come at any time, that he would certainly not be angry, and that he must therefore wake him at once. The footman agreed and went upstairs, taking Levin into the waiting room. Levin could hear through the door the doctor coughing, moving about, washing, and saying something. 3 minutes passed. It seemed to Levin that more than an hour had gone by. He could not wait any longer. "Peter Dmitrievich, Peter Dmitrievich," he said in an imploring voice at the open door, "for God's sake, forgive me. See me as you are. It's been going on more than 2 hours already." In a minute," answered a voice, and to his amazement heard that the doctor was smiling as he spoke. For one instant, in a minute, 2 minutes more passed while the doctor was putting on his boots, and 2 minutes more while the doctor put on his coat and combed his hair. "Peter Dmitrievich," Levin was beginning again in a plaintive voice, just as the doctor came in dressed and ready. "These people have no conscience," thought Levin, combing his hair while we're dying. "Good morning," the doctor said to him, shaking hands, and as it were teasing him with his composure. "There's no hurry. Well, now?" Trying to be as accurate as possible, Levin began to tell him every unnecessary detail of his wife's condition, interrupting his account repeatedly with entreaties that the doctor would come with him at once. "Well, you needn't be in any hurry. You don't understand, you know. I'm certain I'm not wanted. Still, I've promised, and if you like, I'll come. But there's no hurry. Please sit down. Won't you have some coffee?" Levin stared at him with eyes that asked whether he was laughing at him, but the doctor had no notion of making fun of him. I know," the doctor said, smiling. "I'm a married man myself, and at those moments, we husbands are so much to be pitied. I've a patient whose husband always takes refuge in the stables on such occasions. But what do you think, Peter Dmitrievich? Do you suppose it will go all right?" "Everything points to a favorable issue." "So you'll come immediately?" said Levin, looking wrathfully at the servant who was bringing in the coffee. "In just an hour." "Oh, for God's sake. Well, let me drink my coffee anyway." The doctor started upon his coffee. Both were silent. The Turks are really getting beaten, though. Did you read yesterday's telegram? Said the doctor, thoroughly masticating a roll. No, I can't stand it, said Levin, jumping up. So you'll be with us in a quarter of an hour? In half an hour. On your honor. When Levin got home, he drove up at the same time as the princess, and they went up to the bedroom together. The princess had tears in her eyes, and her hands were shaking. Seeing Levin, she embraced him and burst into tears. Well, my dear Elisaveta Petrovna, she queried, clasping the hand of the midwife who came out to meet them with a beaming and anxious face. Everything is going on well, she said. Persuade her to lie down. She will feel easier that way. From the moment when he had waked up and understood what was going on, Levin had prepared his mind to bear resolutely what was before him, and without considering or anticipating anything, to avoid upsetting his wife, and on the contrary, to soothe her and keep up her courage. Without allowing himself even to think of what was to come, or of how it would end, judging from his inquiries as to the usual duration of these ordeals, Levin had in his imagination braced himself to bear up and to keep a tight rein on his feelings for 5 hours, and it had seemed to him he could do this. But when he came back from the doctor's and saw her sufferings again, he fell to repeating more and more frequently, Lord, have mercy on us and succor us. He sighed and flung his head up and began to feel afraid he could not bear it, that he would burst into tears or run away. Such agony it was to him, yet only 1 hour had passed.